Welcome to Going Further and Higher, Shakespeare Martineau's podcast, in which we discuss topical or indeed long-running themes in higher and further education. My name is Smita Jamdar, and I'm partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the issue of protected beliefs, their intersection with other protected characteristics, and with broader concepts such as freedom of speech and academic freedom, and why managing them on campus can be so challenging. I'm joined by David Brown, who's head of our employment education team, and who, like me, has been advising on a number of such cases recently. So, David, maybe we should just start by reminding ourselves and listeners, what is a protected belief in this context?
Okay, thanks, Smita. So, obviously, we're looking at the Equality Act 2010, and philosophical and religious beliefs are one of the protected characteristics under that legislation. What constitutes a philosophical belief for the purposes of the Equality Act is very case sensitive and is very much informed by case law. But we do have some guidance from a case called Granger from a few years ago. And what that identified was that in order for someone's belief to be a protected philosophical belief, five things have to be satisfied. So firstly, the belief must be genuinely held. It must be a belief and not an opinion or viewpoint based on the present state of information available. We might come back to that one. It must be a belief as to a weighty and substantial aspect of human life and behaviour. It must attain a certain level of cogency, seriousness, cohesion, and importance. And again, we might want to come back to that one. And I think the one that probably attracts the most attention is it must be worthy of respect in a democratic society, be not incompatible with human dignity, and not conflict with the fundamental rights of others.
Those are quite big criteria to apply in any case. And I think for me, one of the things that has become probably clearer more recently than ever before is that as a result of that, there is no way of achieving an exhaustive list of protected beliefs. Actually, an infinite number of beliefs can be protected by applying those criteria. And I think what really alarms me is that because belief covers both the belief and lack of belief, for every single protected belief, a lack of belief in that belief could also be a protected characteristic. And frankly, you can start to see why things are feeling so complex on campus when you start to unpick it like that. But if we do go back to some of those criteria then, I do want to talk about the fifth criteria, the worthy
of course,
in a minute. But as you rightly say, a couple of the others are also slightly questionable or challenging when it comes to the university context. And I think you flagged up that the fact that it must be a belief and not an opinion or viewpoint based on the present state of information is quite an interesting criteria for when it comes to academic affairs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing is that one, and also the other criteria around certain levels of cogency, seriousness, cohesion, and importance, I think those two almost coexist, I think. And I think it's possible to fall into the trap of thinking that because it's a weighty issue, therefore someone's opinion about it is bound to be protected. Or conversely, that if it's what might be perceived as being a trivial issue, then it's not substantial enough to be a philosophical belief. I've got a real life example actually from one of my tribunal claims where we had an individual in the education context who didn't agree with the Black Lives Matter movement and argued that that was a philosophical belief for the purposes of the Equality Act. And you can see that on the face of it, that might well satisfy the test because it's a lack of no belief in the Black Lives Matter movement. But on that case, we were successful in getting that kicked out. And it was around that certain level of cogency, seriousness, and it being an opinion at the time, as opposed to actually being something which the law talks about needing to be a philosophical or religious viewpoint, you know, something that is more than just an opinion.
Yeah. And I find that the other aspect that can be quite difficult to navigate is the fact that academic freedom, by its definition, is about testing received wisdom. And yes, it's about putting forward controversial opinions and ideas and so on. But one would expect in the academic context that that's going to be based on evidence, on reason, etc. And then when you get the second of the Granger criteria, which is talking about almost a belief that's impervious to reason, you know, you can't present information to somebody and say, well, you were wrong about that. And that person then changes their view. That's not a belief. That's an opinion. So there is this real inherent tension between the relationship between academic freedom, which we would hope is based around evidence and reason, and the fact that a belief, by definition, isn't. It's based around something more fundamental than just a belief.
It gets complicated, doesn't it?
It really does.
Because I think you've got a different set of tests, really, with academic freedom as you have with philosophical belief under the Equality Act, because the issue, I suppose, with philosophical or indeed religious beliefs under the Equality Act is it's holding them is one thing. It's how you then how that turns into the doing, you know, what you are saying and who you're saying it to. And if somebody has a belief but it doesn't manifest itself in their day-to-day working life, and they're subjected to some form of harassment in respect of it, then you can see that'd be a problem for the employer. It's different with academic freedom, because academic freedom is almost requires the academic to put forward unpopular ideas or test received wisdom. So it requires the doing.
Yes.
I think then you get to the issue, both in respect of philosophical and religious belief under the Equality Act, but especially under academic freedom, is this important element of within the law.
Yes. Well, yes. And there lies another set of challenges. Before we get onto those, though, it is worth just going back to what's called Granger 5, the fifth criteria.
Yeah.
Because that phrase, worthy of respect in a democratic society, could, and I think up to a point, you know, in the judgments at a point in time, was interpreted as being quite a high threshold to cross. But increasingly, it's right, isn't it, that the courts have sort of moved away from that and said, and I think the bit that I think kind of is useful for people to remember is that the state needs to remain neutral, as far as the courts are concerned, between competing beliefs. And therefore, in order to be a protected belief, it should only meet quite modest threshold requirements, because ultimately it is minority beliefs that the law is trying to protect as much as majority beliefs. So Granger 5 isn't quite the hurdle, I think, that people once thought it was.
No, and we were talking about this in preparation for this podcast in terms of some examples of what would constitute a philosophical belief for the purposes of Granger and what wouldn't. And, you know, some of the examples might surprise the listeners. So things like that mediums can communicate with the dead, for example, would be a philosophical belief for the purposes of Granger, but that vegetarianism may not be.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other more, you know, there are other examples which may become more obvious. So, you know, beliefs that clearly would constitute, for example, homophobia would not probably satisfy the test under Granger, but people's views in terms of being gender critical, as we know, have satisfied the test, and the courts have found that that was a philosophical belief, and we know that that has given rise to judgments in favour of the people holding those beliefs.
Yeah, and I think if you go beyond the sort of specific beliefs that have been protected, I think what also becomes clear is some of the ones that have failed so far. So if you take, for example, vegetarianism would be the example you gave, but others were the idea that, you know, Marxism and Trotskyism, they were not protected philosophical beliefs. When you look at the cases, that those judgments were reached by applying the Granger criteria and being found wanted in some respect, not the fifth one necessarily. It wasn't sufficiently cogent, or it wasn't actually a belief, it was a viewpoint or an opinion. So in a different context where a person is able to meet those other parts of Granger, it could well be that those things that were formerly regarded as unprotected are now protected. And I think that, for me, certainly in advising clients on what to do, but even in clients having to then decide how to proceed, is the big challenge, that you have to reach a view here and now about whether you treat it as a protected belief. And as you say, holding it absolute right, manifesting it a qualified right, take your decisions based on the fact that it is a protected belief. Or do you sort of take a harder line and say, actually, we don't think this is a protected belief, but then risk being found wrong further down the line?
It's really hard, you know, and I don't think we're professing to make anything other than difficult set of circumstances for employers and for universities in particular. Ultimately, it will be for a court to decide whether or not, unless you accept that it is in the course of proceedings, it would be for a court to determine whether or not something is a philosophical belief or not. The common sense approach might be, well, you proceed on the basis that that might be coming down the line, and you probably want to take legal advice in respect of it before that, to think, well, actually, how likely is it that this would be a protected belief? And then behave accordingly. But you've got competing issues here. You've got the legal risks against the operational risks, against the interpersonal relationship risks, and requiring people to work together and get on with each other, and not live in an environment where people can say whatever they want to each other, for fear of actually thinking, well, if we take any action, is that going to give rise to claims? It is a minefield, but I think you always have to balance those legal risks against the operational risks and the operational need to just be able to get on with things.
Yeah, and I think that's something that does make these things uniquely problematic, because very often when you're faced with a difficult situation, one option at least is to do nothing whatsoever about it, just to let it take its course. And that could be because you can't, you know, see anything realistically helpful that you might do in that circumstance. But here, if you have that situation where a person is expressing views that they say are a consequence of their protected beliefs, and you have another set of people who are saying, but they amount to harassment of me, and you decide to do nothing whatsoever, the likely outcome is you'll face claims by both sets of people rather than no claim at all. And I'm always struck by the fact that if you say, decide, well, this doesn't amount, this isn't, we're not going to prevent this speech because it's lawful, it's manifestation of protected belief or whatever it might be, it's academic freedom. And that person then continues to be complained about or criticized or treated badly by other people on campus, you then have a duty to try and step in and intervene and prevent those other people from doing those things, whereas they are still busy thinking, we're being harassed here by what's going on. So it's a hugely operationally challenging set of circumstances, but something has to be done, and you have to just form a view that, okay, this is our way through this. Without necessarily the comfort of knowing what at the end of the day a tribunal or a court would decide about all that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's fine to be aspirational in terms of having policies and procedures which talks about dignity and respect, and having codes of practice in terms of how people should treat each other. That doesn't mean that those policies won't come under scrutiny or be challenged by individuals who say, well, I'm just exercising my academic freedom, and what I'm saying is within the law, even if it's robust, and if other people don't like it, it's still within the law. I think it is very much, it's very much a lawyer's answer, but it is a very much case by case basis. But as you say, you have these competing risks, and actually taking no action for fear of the fact that that might give rise to claims might well then give rise to claims from the other individuals who either have the opposing belief or a different belief, and they say that they are being discriminated by their employer, by their fellow employee, who we as an employer are vicariously liable for, unless you take steps to stop that from happening. So I think the distinction always has to be, the sensible distinction has to be between the what and the how.
Yes.
And it's how those beliefs, or how an individual exercising their academic freedom, how it manifests itself, And whether or not it's not what's being said or what's believed, but it's how it's being done. And if it's being done in an oppressive, bullying, certainly discriminatory way, then you're starting to get to the realms of, well, it's not within the law, it's not protected. And also you might be faced by challenges from other people that they're being harassed. So it's a really tricky one.
I know, and I don't know how many times we've used that phrase, but and it does feel very unhelpful to the listeners for us to be doing that. But I think what we can sort of distill is that if people want to discuss ideas and beliefs themselves, then that is probably needs to be given a very, very wide degree of respect. Let people get on with that, even if some people find that offensive or difficult. Once you get onto behavior, which is affecting other individuals, whether through the language that's being used about those individuals, et cetera, if it's more targeted, it's much easier to then see the grounds for intervention safely. But ideas on the on campus probably need to be, you know, the aim of the institution is to encourage a culture in which they can be debated to the fullest possible extent without fear of.
Yeah, and just going back to one of the points you made earlier about sort of saying it's tricky and for listeners finding that potentially unhelpful, I think what I would say is there's going to be lots of litigation, unfortunately, about this. So you won't be an outlier if such a claim is brought in your institution, and to an extent, you just have to grapple with it, with obviously support from lawyers, etc., as necessary, in order to try and get through it. But I think it's just accepted that it is the current state of play,
Yes.
and
Yeah.
it's a really tricky situation, but one in which being pragmatic and being sensible gets you somewhere. The other thing I would say is it might be, I think one of the issues in some of the case law is that there is a presumption that because somebody holds a particular belief, which may not be that high over the threshold in terms of worthy of respect, and maybe one that is a minority belief, is therefore bound to be harassing. And in those cases, you have to be able to establish that that has given rise to that harassment, as opposed to just thinking, well, that belief is not one that I agree with, and therefore it must be offensive to people. It must be harassing. You need to prove that.
Yeah, definitely. But there mustn't be any sense of just reacting to the fact that the belief is held or imputing to people beliefs that go beyond what the ones they hold. So you might not like that, you might not like other aspects of the belief, but that might not be what that individual in particular shares. And this is why the very individualistic nature of these beliefs again makes them quite hard to categorize and to then think about in advance and think, well, how would we manage this? I think one of the points you made there about more litigation and the likelihood that more institutions will lose cases as well, and that is not something that the sector is that used to. It's quite litigation averse. If it does lose a case, that feels like a big institutional moment. And I think there probably does need to be a reappraisal of the risk involved here by leaders and governing bodies. You know, they need to know that they don't have the comfort of thinking we'll never lose a case. It is very likely they will lose a case. That's
But
not the
yeah,
end of the
absolutely.
world.
But conversely, the cases are very much based on their facts,
Yeah.
and we know there is an increasing bank of case law in respect of these issues. But it's still very much on the facts of each case, and I think that is something that any institution can take comfort from, because it just because there's been an adverse finding against another institution with somebody holding that particular philosophical belief doesn't mean that you're going to lose in your case.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming to the end of our time, but there were just a couple of points I wanted to just pick up on. You mentioned earlier that having codes of conduct, having policies around treating each other with dignity and respect, etc., these can be vital in, you know, in an environment of thousands of people to try and make sure that people generally get on and are able to work and study, you know, successfully. My worry is that the regulator, the Office for Students, for those in England, does seem to be starting from the premise that any rules and regulations are inherently a restriction on freedom of speech, rather than thinking about how actually they are necessary in order to have an environment in which everybody feels able to exercise their freedom of speech, rather than those who are feeling harassed or bullied or cowed by the oppressive conduct of anyone else. And so I do think that, you know, that is a fundamental difficulty if we're not able as institutions to set, you know, not necessarily onerous rules, but basic rules about how we interact with each other so that everybody can freely discuss challenging ideas, you know, confidently and comfortably.
Yeah, and I won't say it's a tricky area, just in the interest of variety, I'll say it's a challenging area. But it goes back to my point, I think, about drawing the distinction between the how and the what.
Yes.
And I would like to think that that will become clearer over time, because there has to be some coexistence between employees being able to work in an environment without fear of being completely oppressed by colleagues, and that coexisting with people being able to hold philosophical or religious beliefs, or indeed exercise their academic freedom or freedom of speech. So there must be a coexistence, but I just think that we're not quite there yet.
I agree, because at the end of this, I mean, the solution, if there to all the difficulties we're seeing coming through the various cases and reports, is that we need to create a particular kind of culture, don't we, on campus? We need a culture of tolerance, of pluralism, you know, respect to the extent that that's needed to allow others to express their views freely. And of openness and understanding when things go wrong, that, you know, that it's not a case of somebody's messed up, that's it, they've got to go. That there's work that can be done to try and, you know, improve the culture, improve that. But the law isn't necessarily currently particularly supportive of creating that culture. And that's where I think the next stage needs to move to.
Indeed.
Anyway, thank you very much, Dave, for sharing
your
thoughts.
You're welcome.
I found that very cathartic, I must say. And thanks to all of you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time. So don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And if you like what you've heard, please do leave a review.